Self-awareness, that's what it's all about, is seeing what we can't see. If you can't see it, you can't change it, you can't work with it, you're not acknowledging it, and it's actually causing more harm when it is unconscious. And when it's conscious, it's not as controlling of you. It's not like a total lack of self-awareness or you are completely self-aware, but it's just those nuances. There's always another layer a little deeper. As long as we're human and we're living, there are going to be more layers to observe and to understand.
Welcome to Potent, the podcast where we explore transformative ideas and practices to help you live into your unique potential and build a more potent life. I'm your host, Stephen Lawson, a whole person productivity coach and the founder of Monk Manual. Today, I'm joined by my friend, Leslie McDaniel, founder of HelloPersonality.com. Leslie is a self-discovery coach, podcast host, and curious human whose quest for self-understanding has led her to see the positive ripple effects made possible by self-love. It's through this lens that Leslie uses the core gift process and personality typology to help individuals live into a more authentic version of themselves and bring about greater impact by focusing on what matters most. Today, Leslie and I talk about the significance of self-awareness and personal growth, exploring concepts like personality typology, core gift, and embracing discomfort for development. Today, personality is an interesting topic. There's a lot of interest in personality, and I really trust Leslie's approach, which isn't so much about defining oneself just for a vanity metric or some sort of ego gratification, but really to come to deeper understanding of oneself, because it's through that self-awareness that we end up opening up possibilities for more impact, joy, and peace in our lives. This podcast is brought to you by The Monk Manual. The Monk Manual is dedicated to providing best-in-class tools for helping you build a more potent life and experience peaceful being and purposeful doing on a daily basis. If you'd like to be more intentional with your time and energy, please visit monkmanual.com. All right, let's dive in. Leslie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we've spoken a number of times in the past, and I've always been intrigued by not only the work you do, but also you personally as a human being. And I'd love to start here by just learning a little bit about your own story, how it is you found yourself working in this space of personality and, in a sense, personal gifting.
Yeah. So I could probably sum it up by just saying that I've been searching all my life for something. I've always had a lot of big questions about myself. Who am I? Why am I the way that I am? About other people. Why are other people the way they are? Why am I here? All those types of things. And so I think I've always looked to things to help me understand that. And personality typology is one of those things. And core gifts are one of those things as well. And of course, you know, those systems don't answer all the questions, but they definitely have given me frameworks to help observe myself and to see myself through the lens of those systems. Not that those systems are going to tell me exactly who I am or tell me everything about my life, but I found them super helpful in gaining more consciousness about how I'm showing up and what are my automatic patterns that I don't even realize I'm doing. And maybe some of those are not so helpful. So, you know, I've done a lot of different things in my life, but that's a through line through everything that I've done. There's always this search. Is questioning, why me, why the world, why are we here? All those types of big questions.
Now, what I heard you saying was that from a very early age, it sounds like you've been someone who's been interested in self-awareness, in growing in self-awareness, and probably another layer to that is even maybe a realization that self-awareness actually is fundamental to your own path of personal flourishing. Do you think that that specific maybe orientation towards awareness, is that part of your personality? Or is that something that was learned? Or is that how we should be thinking about personality, kind of like these specific preferences we have?
Yeah. So to the first point of, do I think it's me or personality? I think it's probably both. I don't have a really clear-cut answer for that. But I do know that my personality types in the systems that I work with are predisposed to understanding what's going on underneath. And that involves myself and other people and just the world, looking for the underlying patterns. and then just being a searcher, someone who's seeking meaning and purpose. If you look at the concept that the personality type is something you're born with, and then kind of like life experiences just reinforce that in certain ways, that's kind of the belief, at least with the typology systems that I work with, then yeah, it's been there since birth. So it's definitely innate in me, and it's definitely part of my types as well.
One of the reasons I was excited to have you on is I do think that the people that we tend to attract within the Monk Manual and the broader work that I do tends to be people who do see self-awareness as a path to personal flourishing. But one of the things that's really interesting about personality is in some ways it holds out the promise of greater insight around oneself in trying to actually come to an awareness of that which is innate. The way I actually think about it is it's almost like sometimes if you're like an Arctic seal, but you've been living in the desert, you end up realizing that the reason you're not flourishing is because you're not really playing into the natural ways you're composed, right? Like there's a freedom that can come from some level of maybe affirmation or awareness of how we are specifically designed. But the difficulty is in the search for that which feels innate, I think that there's also patterns that sometimes exist amongst individuals where for one reason or another, we can actually misidentify ourselves or even graft ourselves onto a particular persona that then feels like it's like our personality, but actually it's not. I think I remember actually at one point you alluding to in one particular model, you thinking you were one thing for a particular amount of time and then coming to realize as you went deeper that actually that wasn't the case. And I know someone personally who is a mentor of mine. He told me that his entire life in the Myers-Briggs model, he always thought he was an ENTJ. And then he actually realized when he was like 55 that he was an INFP and it was just his dad was an ENTJ. And so his entire life, in a certain sense, he was kind of projecting that outwards, or at least that's kind of how he was making sense of it as things went on later. So if people are interested in understanding more about their own personality, how do they figure out what's real and what's actually innate versus what's just a projection of what they imagine other people would want them to be?
Yeah. And I think actually that what you're asking, certain personality types are predisposed to doing that more than other types, to kind of taking on the persona, taking on a role. And I think that that's a risk with any label that we put on ourselves, whether it's a personality type or it's a condition or whatever. Not that those things aren't real, right? But there, I think there can be a tendency then for many people to become that. Going back to our previous conversation about this kind of seeking and searching that a lot of people do, I think that you could read a description of a personality type, for example, and find yourself in that if there's something there that's drawing you, something that you need to see or hear or know about yourself. Now, whether or not it's your accurate type may or may not be true, but I think that self-awareness, which we just already talked about a minute ago, is key to understanding, like, am I becoming this thing? Or is this actually truly me? And you can throw out a word self-awareness or a phrase self-awareness like that. And it's not easy. The more self-aware we think we are, the greater the shadow might be of what we're not aware of. So, you know, I myself used to think, oh, pretty self-aware. And then I find out there's a lot of things I don't actually know about myself. The more we can make self-awareness a practice and really looking underneath the surface, underneath our actions, underneath our behaviors, looking at our motivations and all those kinds of things, I think we'll get to the truth of, is this me or is this something I've adopted? Or is it something that I need to take on to make me feel okay about something or to survive a particular experience? You know, it's not all negative. I think that's partly human nature in some ways.
I want to clarify something you said, because you had said that in some ways, the more self-aware that we become, this is what I was hearing, is that the more self-aware that we become, potentially the greater the shadow is that exists around our own, maybe,
can
maybe
I clarify?
Awareness. Like, yes. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So actually what I meant to say, I don't know if I said this, but what I meant to say is the more self-aware we think we are without having the work to back it up. And the reality, like a lot of people think they're self-aware and they kind of toss it aside. It's like, oh, I don't actually need to do any work because I already know all about myself. I've seen that trend. So I think the more we think that we're self-aware and it's not coming from a place of humility, that's when I think there can be a bigger shadow of lack of self-awareness, actually. You know, I've talked to some people and they're like, yeah, of course, I know who I am and I know everything about myself. But there's so much underneath that, I think, yet to be learned. And if you don't open your eyes and you're not willing to look, then I have less confidence in that description of self-awareness. Does that clarify a little bit?
It does entirely. And it makes me want to go down a rabbit hole really deep into a specific, because I even wonder if that's somewhat patterned in terms of particular personalities being more likely to fall into that trap. Like, I think I see that in myself in some ways. And hopefully we can come back to that later in the conversation. But I think what might actually be helpful first is to give a little bit of a primer of, so you work primarily in three different personality models, right? So there's the MBTI, Myers-Briggs, there's the Enneagram, and then there's this core gifting. Is that correct? Those are the three that are kind of the core areas?
Yeah, and I don't actually, so really quickly, Myers-Briggs is talking about specifically the Myers-Briggs type indicator, which is a tool to learn about dichotomies, extroversion, introversion, so on and so forth. I don't actually call it Myers-Briggs. I call it 16 types because I'm working with the Jungian cognitive functions that are underneath those.
Sure.
So yeah, just to make that distinction, but yes, essentially those three things are correct.
Yeah. Could you give a quick overview of each of those models? And I know that that's going to be maybe a gargantuan task in and of itself to just give a really quick overview. But for someone who's maybe not familiar with those things, could you just give a quick overview of what those profiling groupings are trying to do that might be helpful for people who aren't familiar?
Yeah. So I'm going to try to really rein myself in here because I could also get off on a tangent. But okay, so also all three of these things that I do with people are interview based. So they're not tests. It's a conversation that I have with someone. And what I'm looking for are those patterns. So with Myers-Briggs of the 16 types, I'm looking for their brain wiring. It's very cognitive based. So there are 8 different cognitive functions, and I'm looking for which functions do they use and what order do they use them in. That particular order does correspond to a 4-letter type code, which is what we know as Myers-Briggs, like INFJ or ENTJ or something like that. So whereas Myers-Briggs is just looking at a dichotomy, you're either this or that, you're an extrovert or you're an introvert, you're an intuitive or a sensor, the cognitive functions bring more nuance to that because we're all of those things. We all have introverted parts and extroverted parts. We all use intuition and sensing and so on. The Enneagram is a tool that has, well, tools seems inadequate, but because it is a system, but there are some spiritual aspects to it as well. But the typology part, there are 9 basic types. There are 3 subtypes for each, which make 27 types. And this system shows you what emotional patterns you have, which we call the passion, and what cognitive patterns you have, which they call a fixation, or what mental patterns you have that keep you kind of stuck in a box of these automatic patterns that were developed very young as a way to get through the world and a way to experience in the world that was safe in a way. So there's patterns that were developed young and we don't actually need them anymore. They were adaptive patterns at the time and helpful and useful, but now they're very limiting. So the Enneagram helps us to see those patterns that are often very unconscious. There's a lot of other aspects to the Enneagram that I could talk about. There's instincts and other things like that, but that's a very short description. Mm-hmm. And then core gift is about finding your unique purpose and your unique contribution that you can give in all areas of your life. And it's different because whereas the other things I just mentioned have categories like a particular type, 9 types or 16 types or whatever, the core gift doesn't have, there's no categories. It comes directly from the interview with the person and from their words. And it is a through line of their life, of the thing that they're uniquely gifted to give to the world.
It's interesting because I was listening to the language you were using. You were talking about patterns. You were talking about through lines. You're talking about things that are reoccurring. And what's interesting about that language is today, it does seem like the Enneagram is pretty popular. Myers-Briggs is pretty popular. Myers-Briggs also has kind of this interesting popularity even in the corporate world. And you see that a number of voices, sometimes even fairly popular voices, will be fairly critical of both in highlighting that they are, quote unquote, non-scientific, right? And in presenting something more like the Big 5 personality test is, well, this one's actually statistically validated. Maybe this is what should be followed because the Myers-Briggs really, it's not built off of, quote unquote, science. What would you say would be the proper way to understand these various tools within the context of like those criticisms?
Yeah, there's a lot to this question. And I think there's a segment of people, a rather large segment of people, who are going to need something to be scientifically proven and validated in order to trust it at all, to give it any validity, credence, whatever, whatever. There's another set of people who kind of like, if it's something scientifically proven, then I don't need that. It needs to be proven in my own life. Then there's a lot of people in between. I think that sometimes when we are first introduced to a system like this, that's to help us learn about ourselves, there can be loyalty that develops if that system does have an impact, right? So whether that's Big Five or Myers-Briggs or Enneagram or whatever, I think it's human nature, again, to kind of latch on and be like, oh, wow, if it makes an impact, right? If that system makes an impact. With the Big Five, admittedly, I don't know a ton about Big Five. I'm not an expert in that. But my understanding is that it measures traits and it can give you a specific measure of where you are on that particular trait, right? So it's very clear cut. And I think it does give you a sense of like, here's where you can go. But I don't know as far as the growth path, if that's built in. For Myers-Briggs and Enneagram, there is a growth path built in for both. And I think there's also a lot more people in those systems who feel comfortable making a jump of understanding or just seeing if something's personally meaningful to them and accepting it for that reason. You mentioned earlier the patterns and the language, the way I'm speaking about the patterns and the underlying meaning and the through line. That's because I have a preference for a particular type of intuition that makes me think in that way and makes me prioritize those things. So for me, these other systems, if I see that they conceptually work and that there's a pattern that works and they're personally meaningful and impactful and they show me a path for me to grow, that's pretty much all I need. Now, the scientific part, yeah, that's great too. But for me and the people I've worked with and in these communities, that's another thing with the Myers-Briggs and Enneagram. There's often communities that build around these things, which doesn't, in my experience, I don't know, maybe that people do get together and have Big Five meetups. I don't know. So I don't want to diminish that if that does happen, but there are really vibrant communities around these other things. And that, I think, adds to what these systems can give, because there's connection and there's the possibility for helping each other see more of our patterns and so on and so forth. Yeah. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, 100%. And I, you know, I wanted to hear your specific opinion of it because you spend so much time in the space. And part of it is because I'm actually personally very into Myers-Briggs. And I think that I'm fascinated by it because primarily I found it to be helpful. I think one of the things that's interesting, and this is, you know, I don't even know if I'm quite able to articulate this just yet, but we have so many different framings or models for things of how we understand the world. And sometimes when we approach things from a very like, quote unquote, like scientific model, it's actually a specific form of inquiry and it relies on specific types of proofs. And it actually in and of itself maybe can narrow the scope of the level of truth that we can arrive at. And so in some ways, I think there's the truth that's tied to, okay, this is true because it's like materially real. Like this desk is right here, as in I'm holding it right now and I can touch it and I can look at it. There's also the question of, in practice, is something helpful? In the truth, that kind of is just tied to something actually just being helpful. And I've found that Myers-Briggs and the Enneagram are both just very helpful. I also feel that the Big Five, like in kind of even this really maybe more rigid scientific model, it feels a bit more mechanistic, which again, it could be my own skewing, but it feels a little more constraining or diminishing.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I actually had a conversation with one of the groups that I'm in that it's the Myers-Briggs profiling type stuff that we do. And several of the people in there talked about the Big Five, showing them things they already knew about themselves. Like it wasn't a surprise. And how the Myers-Briggs and Enneagram and other things like that really gave them depth to go deeper and to show them more about themselves. I think also one of the things that some of the groups that I'm in where I'm learning about how to do this conversational thing to identify someone's personality type, we've gathered a lot of, it's qualitative evidence, right? But it's a lot of evidence from people of the same type and how the patterns exist in the people of the same type. So it's not the type of scientific proof that you can run a scientific method on, but it is proof. It's showing that these patterns, like you just said, are real and they do show up in people. And there's a large quantity of people. after they've been profiled that we can say, okay, an ENTJ looks like, or at least their mind works like this. Can an ENTJ show up in many different ways? Absolutely. But if we're looking at the pattern is still true. And going back to my previous point about people who, some people don't trust patterns very easily, and they need the actual concrete proof, like you said, like this is here right now, and I can point to it and say that it's real, or I've personally experienced it. Other people have more comfort with just accepting the pattern.
I want to take a second to just kind of explain a little bit of my own journey with personality, just because I think that it's going to be helpful to lead into where I'm currently seeing a really big opportunity, and where I think for a lot of listeners, they may actually find a great level of utility. So I first was introduced to Myers-Briggs maybe about 10 years ago. I took a test for, I think, a job, or maybe it was within the context of a job. And when I read it, I was like, oh, this makes a lot of sense to me, because I actually do feel like I have kind of strengths, or my mind works in this way, or my mind works in that way. And that was really helpful. And then it became this thing where I just got really interested in studying the different types. And I kind of would almost play this game with myself where, because I do think the way my mind works is I'm always trying to look for patterns. So I would be in conversations with people. I'd meet someone new and I'd kind of start thinking like, oh, I wonder what this person is. And I'd sometimes do almost this like guessing game where I would ask them what it was. And I would kind of guess in my head what I thought it was. And I found that probably about 9 out of 10 times I was correct about what that was within a short period of time. So that was one of the reasons why I was like, okay, there is something here. And there's been a whole path around the Enneagram as well. And that's been really, really helpful. I would argue more from almost like a spiritual or emotional standpoint of understanding kind of like where our foot is stuck in the concrete, right? Like the thing that we're not even aware of that's maybe holding us back. That just, it's one of those things that I think when you come in contact with your typing specifically within that model, it's something that almost makes you feel like a little bit, not bad, but it strikes a nerve, because you're like, it's kind of the part of you that you don't really want to look at. Whereas a lot of other things, even like a strengths finder, it's something that you're like, oh, this is great. These are my strengths. But with that, it's like, ooh, this is like my wounding. I don't really want to show that thing. And yeah, actually that has caused a lot of problems in this capacity and that capacity and this capacity. But there is a lot of things that can help you around that particular use case. But actually what's been most interesting for me has just happened in the past year, which is I've dove in more to some of like the cognitive functions. So something I realized was working with a team, the people that I work with the Monk Manual, and also trying to really steward the Monk Manual well and serve different personalities ultimately. Because that's one of the things I think about, is it's like, how do I create a tool or tools or content that actually meets people where they're at, knowing that the way their minds work, the way they view the world, the way they view themselves, it actually is going to be different. And so I started realizing like, a lot of these people that I'm working with, like their minds just don't work the exact same way. Like it's very different. My mind's always worked the way it's worked, right? And then I started realizing like other people don't experience it this way. And I remember actually, I think it was maybe a year ago, explaining to someone on my team, I was like, my mind, it's almost like when I'm thinking, it's almost like this matrix where I kind of go from here to here, and then there's like doors, and then I move through the door, and then there's like a whole nother matrix. And it's kind of like this layered thing. And a lot of it's more visual. And it was funny because I could tell like that's not how other people's minds work. And then what I ended up realizing was I was looking at the cognitive functions for my specific type, and it described that exactly, like that actual process as being for my specific function, whatever that was, being like, this is how this mind works. And I was like, oh, this makes so much sense. But what's been most interesting and helpful for me is how it can open us up to understanding that other people are not like us, which then actually tears down some of the barriers and enables us to actually communicate better, to serve other individuals better, to just engage the world better. Because when we realize what's specific maybe to us, we also realize that other people have things that are specific to them. So have you traveled somewhat of a similar path? Do you find a lot of your clients experience a similar path, or what does that look like?
Yeah. So I think what you're talking about is this understanding that I am different than this person, and we all don't see the world in the same way, right? And I think that is the basis for empathy, first of all, to your point of like being able to step into someone's shoes and say, oh, their mind is not wired in the same way. And that starts with that self-awareness. So your question of like, do my clients, do the people that I work with travel a similar journey? I think yes, like it may not be the exact same thing where they recognize that people don't think in the same way, but there's a shock point of something, of some kind. That shock point can be like, I've been doing this thing my whole life and now it doesn't feel fulfilling anymore. And I don't understand why. Or it could be, I'm in relationship with this person and I don't understand why they don't get it, right? Because maybe you don't understand that their brain is wired differently. There can be a lot of types of shock points or transitions, but I do find that that search or that seeking that happens and that at that point leads people to systems like this many times.
Something that's really interesting, because we're talking about how our own capacity for maybe understanding ourselves better really does have the potential for some level of transformation. But there's also something that I've seen as a pattern, and I think I've even fallen into myself at certain times, where it's like you go and you take like a test, you go and figure out like, this is what I am, or you find something that you identify with and maybe feels kind of good, because in some ways, if it is aligned with you, it's somewhat validating, right? It's like, I don't know, it's always nice to kind of hear like, oh, you have a strength in this area, or to even be validated in your experience of like, oh yeah, that is how I experience the world, or that is the thing that I feel. Something that can be, I think, a stumbling block is, for some people, it can almost feel like the pursuit of understanding oneself can become like just like an ego trip or a little bit of like a vanity project. And then it actually becomes like an excuse of like, oh, well, I'm this way, so that's why I can be a jerk, or I'm this way, so that's why I actually am not going to do this type of thing, or I'm not actually going to do this thing that's kind of hard in this particular way, right? It almost becomes a way to excuse ourselves from maybe specific aspects of a role within a family or within an organization or whatever it might be. It becomes this way to actually kind of like buffer ourselves from growth rather than becoming a path to growth. Do you find that as kind of a universal temptation that we face? And how do you redirect that energy or that capacity we have to kind of turn inwards on ourselves in a way that's maybe more about affirming ourselves rather than actually moving forward with that and reaching a new potential within ourselves?
Yeah, I see two parts to what you're talking about. The first part being the like learning more and more, right? And kind of like it being an ego trip, or it being like, let me just continue to learn more about myself. And I think that is a trap, because if it's disconnected from action or like making that meaningful and working towards a transformation to get out of some of those automatic habits, to get out of some of those patterns that aren't working, then personality type or any other system or anything else is pointless. It's not helpful. And that's actually not what the systems I work with were designed for anyway. Talking about taking on a label or being like, well, that's just how I am, that aspect of it, I think you don't need personality typology for that. I think there's a lot of people who are like, oh, I just am this way and I'm not going to change, right? I think that is a lack of a growth mindset to begin with. And I think we all can get there, stuck there at certain points of our life, depending on our life circumstances. Sometimes things are really difficult and it is hard to have a growth mindset and to think about moving forward and to change things that aren't working. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that I feel like all of these things, both of these things, can be a trap for anyone who doesn't have that mindset of like, I'm going to use this to see what my potential is and move towards it, or to activate more of my potential or my potency or what I'm capable of or what my purpose is. If that's not the goal and that's not the aim and the purpose, then these things aren't helpful at all. And they actually can be harmful, because if you put yourself in that box, which, by the way, we're already in some level of box and these systems help us see more about that. But if we put ourselves in that box, and we're putting everyone else in that box too, and there's no room for growth, there's no room for transformation, there's no room for real authentic impact.
There's one part of that which has to do with thinking about our personality, or thinking about even like how we're maybe designed, as a way of like, yes, I'm trying to understand the way I'm built, the way I function, through a lens of just growth. So one side of that is like, okay, you can look at anything and not look at it through a lens of growth. And so in some ways, personality is just like anything else, where it's like you can look at it through a lens of growth or through a lens of kind of the static state, and you're going to get a lot more out of it if you look at it through a lens of growth. The other part, and what was interesting to me about what you were just saying, was that it's not something that can just be this theoretical reflection project that's not tied to actual action in doing the work. And this goes back to something I was going to bring up earlier. It's interesting. I once asked people in the Monk Manual community, in a Facebook community we have, just out of curiosity, I was like, what's everyone's Myers-Briggs? Because I was just like, this would be really interesting to see what people say. 80% of people were like intuitive, right? Versus sensing. And maybe that's just has to do with who's online on Facebook doing this particular thing. But that struck me as like, yeah, that kind of makes sense that in general, more people would be attracted to even a podcast like this who are more kind of like thinking about maybe abstracted things or like bigger picture things. Now, the thing that's interesting is I understand it from a Myers-Briggs standpoint. I am an intuitive and I'm actually like very profoundly intuitive. Like that's the one area that I'm very, very high, and not high as in I have, if people aren't familiar with this model, it's not high as in like I got a great grade. It just means like I'm almost disproportionately skewed in one area and I have also disproportionate weaknesses in the other. And I find this sometimes with people who are more of like intuitive types, and this is why I'm drilling into this, because I think a lot of listeners might be, they can actually struggle with like doing the concrete work. I've seen this as a pattern as well, where it's like, it can be really comfortable to just intellectualize everything and to just think about things versus actually engaging with the real. What I'm hearing you say though is, and I wouldn't be surprised if you might not even attract similar people to who the Monk Manual attracts, but that like sometimes that gap, like the thing that's not our natural preference, is actually the path itself. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Yeah, I would probably need to sit with that for a little bit to say 100%. But I mean, on the surface, Yes, I think. OK, so if we're talking about the Myers-Briggs, Jungian cognitive functions, the whole reason Carl Jung, well, I'm going to say the whole reason, this may not be the whole reason, but one of the big reasons that he sort of came up with these functions, it's not about like labeling yourself. And he really, from what I understand, kind of got irritated with the way people were using it in the typology way, because he was all about integration and becoming more whole and seeing these things as problems. Now, I'm not talking about the other systems, but I'm talking about this, like seeing your dominant function, for example, the thing that you're always doing so much, or the things that you're doing too much, as a problem. And it's a problem because it's not balanced by the other side. So in this particular system, every cognitive function has an exact opposite, and they're on a polarity. So when one side is like overused and the other side is ignored, you're not really balanced or whole in that way. So I don't know if this is answering your question, but it's what's coming to mind when I'm thinking about that, the path of growth being the things that you are not naturally paying attention to. And this system helps you to see like, oh, okay, so I'm not giving, for example, enough time and energy to the concrete. Maybe I should do some work there, right? Because I could probably see lots of areas in my life in which that's a problem. And that's caused me stress and distress and difficulty. Or same thing with the thing that you're doing all the time. Like, I could probably see where that's overrun in my life a lot of ways and cause problems and difficulties and so on and so forth. So if we go back to the core concept of self-awareness, these systems are only tools. They're just tools to help you see those things about yourself. Sometimes we can see them about ourselves without a system or a tool, but certain things, they shed a light on certain things that can be really, really difficult because they're so unconscious or they're so automatic that we don't even know that we're doing them.
Yeah, there's this experience we have of like when we're in our own, it's like we're on the inside of the bottle and it's really hard to read our own label, right? And I'm not saying label here as in like type. I'm just saying in general, like it's hard for us to see how other people experience us. I really do think I try to be fairly self-aware, and I've had people say that I'm a fairly aware person, but I really feel as if I have a very poor sense of how other people experience me because I've just never been on the other side. And there's also this level to, you know, in the Monk Manual, we have something that's an inventory on every month that kind of has you rate how you personally want to assess yourself in various areas, things like your work or I should know off the top of my head, but there's a number of different
play,
areas
spiritual
where you
life.
Play.
Yeah.
But it's funny because I like one of the reasons that I think that's actually a powerful utility is because you start to see that, okay, there's certain areas you tend to always under optimize. At least for me, I tend to always have certain things that's like, okay, I'm really devoting a lot of energy to this, and this thing I'm not devoting a lot of energy towards. And what's interesting about that, and what I was hearing, what you're saying is like, we have this tendency to sometimes continue to favor our strength or continue to favor the things that we think work for us or certain ways of approaching things when a lot of our path of growth or progress is in the integration of the things that are not normally what we do or are not normally where we emphasize our focus. Do you think that's because we're just not aware of those areas primarily or because doing those things are just really hard and it's easier to just kind of keep doing what we're doing?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of the latter. Like as a human being, I think there's a lot of things about us that are designed to conserve energy and to be safe, right? And to be secure and to be comfortable. Now, I'm not a biologist and, you know, I don't study the human body, but that's my understanding that our brains, like we form patterns and those conserve energy because we can do it quickly. We don't have to think about it, blah, blah, blah. So I think there can be a natural tendency for many people to want to stay stagnant. I'm saying that, but then going back to what I said at the beginning, like I think there's also people who are designed to kind of see that there must be something more and to desire that and to want to move towards that. But that desire, the want, even if that's innately in there, it does take work. It does take energy. It takes effort. It takes action. It takes intention to move towards that path. Like, as I said at the beginning, like if I had those questions, I could just have those questions and just sit in my own space or read books and whatever, whatever, unless I sought out something that's going to actively move me toward answers to those questions that I had, then is it really doing anything? Is it helpful? I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think something that's worth pointing out as well, because we're talking about, and I do think a lot of the people who are listening, they want to, I mean, just by the nature of listening, you're probably trying to achieve some level of personal potential, right? And so you're probably someone who is trying to reach further. And sometimes it can also be a little bit overwhelming of thinking like, oh, there's so many things I need to consider. And how are all these blind spots potentially impacting me? And yeah, you know, I'm trying to do the work, but like I'm also maybe scared or maybe there's this thing or that thing. And it can sometimes feel like there's such a gap between where we are and where we imagine we could be. And in a certain sense, that's real because I do think that there's a really great capacity that we hold. But I wanted to highlight that it's also just like a process, right? It's all a process that unfurls over time. And I know in our last conversation, we were talking about the work that you do. And I noticed where there's a lot of energy for you right now is around this core gift model, helping people to understand their core gift. Could you share a little bit about what is it that brought you from the personality work that people might be more familiar with to this idea of core gift? And what's kind of this core gift idea offer, either in addition to or beyond what some of these other personality models might?
Yeah. Before I answer that, I want to go back to something you said at the beginning and just make a comment, because I think it's really important that for people who do see that gap from where they are to where they could be, there could be an inner critic telling you that you're not doing enough. There can be shame around that. There can be a lot of angst for a lot of people that can then pull you down. But I think to your point of it being a process, so, so important to understand. That's been difficult for me even in my work of trying to be present with whatever is right now. That's a huge piece of growth as well. And I just want to encourage people to recognize that's part of self-awareness too, of like, am I being a little too hard on myself? Am I not accepting the things I actually have done? Am I not being present with where I am in life right now? Am I only living for that future vision? So I think that's a really important thing to remind people, because there is such a thing as getting caught in a personal growth spiral and feeling like you have to keep doing that. And that's the only thing that's okay. Resting is okay too. But to your question about the core gift process, I will always work with personality type. I love personality type. I'm not giving it up. But I think this offers another facet of self-awareness and understanding. And all of the work that I do with people is helping them understand what matters most part of that is understanding who you are, but what really, really, truly matters to you, not what matters to your mom or your dad or your boss or blah, 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 and not adopting any identities, but what really, really matters to you. The core gift discovery process offers an insight into the thing that you are uniquely gifted to give to the world. It's your greatest contribution. I think it offers a filter in your life of making decisions for the things that matter most. And that's going to lead to, ultimately, a more fulfilling life, a life with more meaning, a life with more purpose. And while personality systems, I think, can shed a little bit of light on that, I haven't seen it in the way that this process does. So I think it's complementary in a lot of ways.
Out of pure curiosity, is that process something that starts with some deep self-inquiry and tries to find where the inner gold is, as it were, of like what's actually meaningful and then kind of builds up from there? Or is it something where you're starting with, here's what I think it could be, and you're refining and bouncing it off of people? What does that actually look like?
Yeah. So the process, the core gift discovery process, has actually been developed over about 30 years. It was at first used with youth and helping them to see like, oh, I actually do have something good to contribute to the world. And it also has roots in indigenous cultures have a process in which the young people come up and they understand from their community, what is the gift that I have that I can offer? So there's some other aspects to this process, but the way that I use it and the way I've learned is it's an interview process where I ask a series of questions and we capture kind of the nugget from that question. And at the end of the process, without getting really specific, the end of the process, we organize all of those nuggets into themes and categories, and we look for the through line. And that through line is the core gift. It's the thing that emerges from all the things that you've said. And while the process does have a list of specific questions, from what I understand is that really there's any number of questions you could ask. It's really just getting at the core underlying motivation of your answers. And from that emerges this core gift. Does that help explain the process a little more?
Mm-hmm. It does. And I know my sense is that it's something that can evolve over time. It's a process in and of itself, right, to really arrive at it, because there's greater depth, right, that we access for ourselves. In your experience, when people are working through the core gift process, is it the sort of thing where they're surprised by what their core gift is, or is it more so something where you just help them give words to something that they've always known on some level?
Yeah. It's a little bit of both, but there's definitely a piece of like, so when that core gift is revealed, there's always some reaction. There might be emotion for the person. There might be a big smile. There might be a like, huh, you know, there's some reaction of like, okay, yes, I can see this. And that's, we have a series of questions that we go through to kind of like validate the accuracy of it to see if this actually is the core gift. And one of them is like, do you see this in your life? Has there been a situation in your life that was essentially the opposite of this? Because that situation, that difficulty is what motivates us to give our gift. So I think for most people, there is a knowing, there's an inner knowing. And so this process does raise up something that is known, it may be deep within. And that's what coaching does anyway, right? Like as a coach, I'm not telling anyone, I'm not giving advice, I'm not telling them anything about their lives. It's asking a series of questions to unearth something that is already within them. And it may not be right there on the surface of their understanding, but once it comes up, there's usually recognition. The surprise part often comes with how much of an impact it's had in their life for good and possibly for bad. Just like we were talking about earlier with the dominant function in the 16 type system, there can be a recognition of like, oh my gosh, like I've been doing this even when I didn't need to do this, or I've been doing this so much that maybe it's caused me problems in life. Because the core gift is not always something that you just doing out of the goodness of your heart. Like sometimes there are negative motivations for it because it's the thing you're always wanting to do. And I think there can also be a recognition of the ways in which you've used it when you didn't need to do it. Like you're overdoing it, you're overusing it. So that part, I think, can be the surprise.
I'm inspired by a vision for our own potential being tied to our creative capacity, and not creative capacity from a standpoint of like how many paintings someone churns out or how many book someone writes or how many accolades they get in a career, but creative from a standpoint of in every moment, there is a creative potential before us to make something that is good or bad or neither, or to not make anything at all. And that's always the opportunity. And again, here, I'm not necessarily saying materially something. I'm saying like you can go and engage your kids or your spouse, and it can be a creative experience. I want to walk around this idea of core gift, because as I understand it, or as I'm trying to process through it, to me, it plays into this idea of our own creative capacity. And how I'm making sense of it is maybe at a young age, we identified when we encountered certain levels of like darkness in the world or things that were less than ideal, that maybe imprinted on us something that is like tied to that gifting, right? Like the core gift is in a sense, sometimes maybe also tied to like a core wound. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. So there are a lot of different types of gifts that we can have. This particular type of gift, the core gift, the process that I use, it is tied to a wounding, a difficulty, we could call it. And that runs the gamut for different people as to how difficult it was or how wounding it was. But the idea and the understanding is, and we've seen this in people, is that that experience, that difficulty, that wounding provides the motivation for us to give that thing, the thing we wish we had during that time period, to other people. And so we kind of go about our lives giving that and giving it and giving it in an attempt to actually heal ourselves. And when we do give it in a healthy, positive way that is impactful for other people, and it's not driven by these other motivations that are negative, we actually do heal ourselves. So I think if that's what you're asking, yes, it spurs us on. It cracks open the gift and our desire to give that to other people and ignites a process of healing for ourselves.
I want to highlight this because I think, and obviously there's so much more that could be covered in this, and I encourage people to follow up if there is interest in going further into this core gift process. But what I want to highlight here is that if we pause, we can potentially see patterns of how we've been trying to help the world or help others or create good or heal something. And that in fact, that's all an attempt, or it's all rooted in the desire to heal ourselves. And that doesn't make it bad. Although, as you were saying, it can have negative consequences because probably it could maybe take over and be more compulsive versus intentional. But I think that's such an important thing to dwell on, because when you can see, as I'm listening to you in real time, I'm kind of processing it for myself. And I'm like, yep, there. Even right now, I think I'm doing some of what's probably tied to my core gift and also my core wound, right? And that's so fascinating. And even that has a certain level of freeness or space that seems to come from it, because anytime you make unconscious patterns conscious, they don't go away, but you're at least able to engage them. You're at least able to be a little more intentional about taking care of them.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And that, again, self-awareness, that's what it's all about, is seeing what we can't see. And if you can't see it, you can't change it, you can't work with it, you're not acknowledging it. And it's actually causing more harm when it is unconscious. And when it's conscious, it's not as controlling of you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask a question, Leslie, from your own path, because I know that you're someone who, in a sense, it sounds like from a young age, you were interested in self-awareness. And now your actual profession is just, I mean, it's in the space of self-awareness. And there's something that kind of, because I experienced this in my coaching as well. You learn more about it yourself even when you're learning about other people, right? So when you're going and doing this work, it's like these people are all mirrors in some way as well, right? And I think you've more than most probably spent a lot of time in growing in self-awareness. Are there any specific either tools or practices that you found to be really helpful for you personally?
Yeah, I think I'll speak to currently what I'm working with, and that is a real awareness and connection to my body and what my body intelligence can tell me. Because even things like, okay, maybe I'm sitting with a client and I notice my hands are clenched, or I notice that I'm like tensing my body. I'm like, huh, what's that about? You know? And that reminds me to relax and notice what's going on for me at the moment and redirect my attention back to the client. or just in any interactions, even today, as you're talking to me, I'm trying to maintain an awareness of what's going on for me in my body, because that shows me maybe what's hitting, bringing up something for me that I need to address. So that body awareness piece, I've been doing like some practical examples would be like doing free movement in groups where they ask you to notice what's coming up for your body and to move in a way that feels good. It's kind of a little strange for me. It's a new type of thing, but I've been doing that. I think also another practice, I don't know if we could call this a practice, but is being in group or community with people. And it may be just a small group of people that are also doing this type of work and that you trust and that you can be vulnerable with and that they can share feedback with you to help you see things maybe that you can't see yourself or to give you a new insight on something. And it's not like a total lack of self-awareness or you are completely self-aware, but it's just those nuances. Like you mentioned layers earlier. There's always another layer, a little deeper. As long as we're human and we're living, there are going to be more layers to observe and to understand. So yeah, so the body awareness practices and the group interactions I've found really helpful for myself. Mm-hmm.
I love that you highlighted that with the body movement work that you're doing, that it's actually not maybe intuitively something you'd be comfortable with or attracted to. And because of that, that's in a sense why you're doing it, which speaks to you really trying to live it, this idea of like integration and leaning into the areas where maybe you wouldn't normally lean. Something that happened during COVID, one of the enjoyable things with COVID, my wife and I actually for the first time got into watching Seinfeld. Mm-hmm. And we watched through pretty much all of Seinfeld throughout COVID. And there's one particular episode that is by far my favorite episodes, and it's with George Costanza, who the episode starts and he says something along the lines of like, I realize that everything, every decision and everything I've ever done has been wrong. It's everything I do is wrong. So from now on, I'm going to do the exact opposite of what I'd normally do. And everything works out. He gets like a girlfriend. He gets hired by the Yankees. It's like the whole episode that is about how everything goes great for him. And I just love that so much because we do get stuck in these various patterns, right? And I'm actually intentionally trying to do that this year, is in as many times as I'm able to bring it to mind, if I can identify like something's happening, to almost be like, I'm going to just do the opposite of what I normally do here, right? If it's like normally I would go and prepare for X amount of time beforehand, maybe I won't prepare at all this time. Or maybe I'll go and I'll approach this thing in a different way, or I'll go and I won't defend myself at all when this person's like criticizing me or whatever it might be. Mostly just to see how it feels. Right. And just to see, like, is there something there for me? And I think that's what I'm hearing in part, like what you're doing, and also speaks to kind of an opportunity for really anyone, is like just trying it and seeing how it feels and seeing what might be there for you, because you might find something that's really, really has a strong utility.
Yeah, I don't know that I'm quite to the point where I do the exact opposite. I definitely in that space notice my inclination to not want to do something or to want to do something, and then I explore why. But yeah, with the body stuff, and even like I'm taking singing lessons as well recently, or I've just started that for working with my voice. I'm working with a mindfulness teacher who's also a singing teacher. So it's not about becoming a performer. But yeah, and that's deeply uncomfortable for me, those types of things. But even choosing to do those activities, I'm able to see some results of the growth I've done, and even be able to be here with you and talk to you and not feel super self-conscious, which is my trend throughout my life. It shows me, oh, okay, yeah, things have changed for me. I've still got work to do, obviously. But putting ourselves in situations that may on the surface feel uncomfortable, not dangerous, of course, but uncomfortable because it's pushing at our edges, I think is really valuable. And even just noticing like, I'm absolutely not going to do that. Okay, well, why? Why would you not ever in a million years do that, which I have said about certain things, and just noticing that. Yeah. So I think that's these things that I've mentioned are just examples of the result of some of the work I've done. It's where I want to go. And I think they're helping round me out in a lot of ways.
Just even the actual act of doing something a little different or something that you wouldn't normally do. Once you do it, you feel like you've expanded a little bit. Mm-hmm. Right. Like you feel like at least your options have expanded. You could say like, OK, now that's not, I'm not intimidated by that. Or maybe you're still intimidated, but it doesn't have the same grip. So that's also one of those things that I find can have some utility. It's like if I actually can pay attention to the things that scare me most and I don't want to do. Not I don't want to do them because they're morally things that I don't want to do, mm-hmm. but I don't want to do them because I just am like, oh, I don't really want to do that. Like, I don't really want to go and do that. That's going to feel confrontational, or that's like an uncomfortable situation to be in. Those are the areas where I tend to find like, man, that's the greatest opportunity, or that's, or it's maybe the place where I've been holding back the most. And it's actually like the thing that does have some potential for my gifting to ultimately be shared with the world. I want to transition to a few rapid fire questions to close things out. If you could go back in time 10 years ago, what advice would you give yourself?
Yeah. So I'm talking about self-awareness. I really don't like this question because I don't like thinking about going back and telling myself to do something different. But as I process through this, because you gave me this, I would say that you are okay where you are. You're not going to be where you are in a few years, but it's totally okay where you are, and to work on loving yourself, because one day you actually will love yourself. I think that's what I would say.
What's something you're trying to cultivate more of right now?
Yeah, presence and body awareness, 100%.
What is something that you know for sure?
Again, hesitant to say I know anything for sure at this point in my life, but I would say the thing that came to mind was that curiosity is always greater than judgment.
What's something you're still trying to figure out?
How to stay present in my body and the present situation.
What's one piece of advice you could give people on how to live a more potent life?
Yeah. I would suspect that the person listening might have trouble slowing down. So I would say, number one, slow down. Like, really take time to go inside and figure out what actually truly matters. And then give all your energy to those things only.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Thank you so much, Leslie. You are a wonderful human being. Thank you so much for coming on. Can you tell those who are listening where they might be able to learn more about you and your work?
Yeah, you can just go to hellopersonality.com. That's my website. I do have a podcast called the Hello Personality Podcast as well, on all major podcast places, I think. But yeah, I'd love to see them.
Beautiful. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of Potent. If you'd like to learn more about Leslie and her work helping individuals come to deeper levels of personal awareness and potential, please visit hellopersonality.com. I invite you now to take a moment to identify something from today's episode that you'd like to change or incorporate into your life as a result of what you heard today. Don't let ideas stay ideas. Find one small action you can take starting today to set yourself on a path to a fuller life. If you haven't already, I invite you to subscribe to this podcast and please leave us a review. This is a free way you can support this program and help us to reach more individuals who are seeking to live a fuller life. You can also follow us on YouTube and Instagram. Links to both are available on our website, thepotentpod.com. And now, some inspiration for the week ahead. If I take death into my life, acknowledge it, and face it squarely, I will free myself from the anxiety of death and the pettiness of life. And only then will I be free to become myself. Martin Heidegger. Until next time.